on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another School for Startups Radio. Boy, are we cram-packed today. First up, we're going to talk about perseverance with Manny Skilafilax, welcoming back to the show. And then Dr. Barbara Hales, also a repeat guest, is going to talk to us about medical marketing. Wow, we have a theme show here. I didn't even realize it. Repeat great favorite guests of mine. Crowded show. We're going to have two long conversations, so we need to get started. Here we go. Very excited to welcome back to the show one of our favorites. Please welcome Manny, Skilafilax. I practiced beforehand and then I lost it. Say it again, Manny.
Skilafilax.
That is it. I bet your wife took a long time to learn that one.
For sure. Thanks for having me on the show.
He has just released a new book called The Small Business Preser. What's the book called? I remember
Small Business Perseverance Guide, How to Make Money and Prosper During Challenging Times.
Okay, here I am. I just found it. I don't know why I clicked away like a moron. Well, congratulations on the book, Manny. Tell us about it.
Sure. You know, I wrote this book because too many business owners are doing everything right. You know, they're working hard, they're staying committed, but they still feel stuck. And in my opinion, the truth is that perseverance isn't just about pushing through as a business owner. It's about having like the right financial strategies in place so you can adapt and stay profitable and grow even when times get tough. And this book is a playbook for small business survival and success. And my goal is to help as many entrepreneurs as possible feel confident and in control again.
All right. I certainly feel out of control all of the time. What are the reasons for that? Why are we feeling this way? Is it the economy? Is it because of Trump? Is it because of what? What is it?
You know, I feel that the economy is softening around us. When you look at the statistics that are being published and the layoffs that are going on and the price of everything has gone up, grocery store, insurance, et cetera. And I always felt like I was seeing the same movie again when I would go through economic downturns. I've been through like four of them in my career. And I always saw that the ones that survived the downturns were the ones that were already prepared for one. They were preparing every day, Jim, as opposed to, you know, saying, oh, shucks, something happened. Let me do something.
All right. I find that to be true too, but how do I get prepared for the downturn?
So what do I great question about? Sure. So, you know, in my opinion, perseverance is about strategy. It's knowing your numbers as a business person, anticipating challenges, and then making small, deliberate adjustments before the problems become crises. So it's not just about surviving. It's planning ahead to keep control when things get tough.
Does that mean having a bucket of money on the side for a rainy day?
You know, that's one of them. And that's a great point you make.
I can barely afford to keep the door open right now. And you want me to have a bucket set aside that I don't spend? Are you crazy?
You know, I understand that it's simple, but it's not easy. But it really, really is the difference between, you know, you being stressed out all the time and you being able to get a good night's sleep.
All right. Let's go through the book and learn some of the pieces. Where should we start?
Let's talk about cash flow. It's the lifeline of every business, right? So your profit looks good on paper, but cash flow is what keeps the doors open. And then during challenging times, managing your cash flow, it's not optional. It's oxygen. So you have to be in a position to predict the cash shortage before it happens and take proactive steps to fix them. So that would be number one.
Okay. Cash flow is so hard to predict based on when customers make payments, right? Is that?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
I feel like I'm always fighting for payment.
Yes. So that's an area then that you should take a look at and see what you can do with your payment terms and do your best to not let your customers use your business as a bank. That is definitely first and foremost, because profit looks good on paper. But again, cash flow is what keeps the doors open.
All right. So how do I go to make my third request that you pay the bill? Damn it, Manny.
You know what? One thing that I've recommended to my clients, Jim, is that you put in your contract from the beginning that you reserve the right to suspend services in the event of past due payments. And you will be surprised how that gets everybody's attention.
So what if they still don't pay? What about the threat? Well, I'm going to tell everyone on Twitter that you're not paying me. That would do any good?
I mean, that's a whole different ball game. You know, if it's just as simple as it could be so many things on why they're not paying you. You don't really want to get into a situation unless you have to send them to a collection agent, you know, because that pretty much heralds the end of the relationship. But I found in my experience that managing the relationship in the beginning with respect to payment discipline is important. Don't let them stress you out. S-T-R-E-T-C-H.
In the book, you talk about flexible payment and budgeting. How does being flexible help me sleep at night?
Sure. Great question. You know, so first and foremost, diversifying your revenue, not being dependent on just one way to make money. Try to have 3, 4, 5 ways to make money in your business. Being on top of your supplier terms, right? Renegotiating them if you can. It's important to keep a great relationship with not only your clients, but your suppliers as well. And then that big one that you mentioned, Jim, keeping the cash reserve. You don't build resilience during a storm. You build it before it hits.
Yeah, but as I said, it's so hard to keep that reserve when there's a marketing opportunity, you know? I don't need the reserve. I'll spend it on marketing and have more income, and then I'll have replenished the reserve.
I mean, it's an excellent point you make. But it's, you know, it's a delicate balance. So it sounds like for you, you're less risk averse and I'm more risk averse. You're confident keeping less of a reserve and I'm more conservative. I'd like to keep some kind of reserve in case I get stuck with some clients that aren't paying me on time. So I guess it goes down to each person's individual appetite.
Yeah, I've just gotten so risk adverse. The older I get, the less I'm interested in it. So
I understand. Yeah, the other piece of this. Sure, go ahead.
No, sorry. You go ahead.
You know, small businesses win when they focus on margins, not just sales. So the whole reason I have a career is I've been helping business owners focus on making more money as they grow. Don't just grow the size of the company from 1 million to 2 million or 5 million to 10 million and not make any more money. That means you need to chase your margin and that creates stability. And you can increase your profits without increasing revenue just by finding and fixing some hidden leaks in your cost structure. You know, sometimes a small 2 or 3% margin improvement can sometimes, you know, have a massive effect on a business's take-home profit.
How do I increase prices in today's world where everyone is so stretched already?
That's a great point and a tough question. You know, in my experience, you have to demonstrate value to your client. If you're dealing with your client and they believe that your service is a commodity, then your goose is cooked, right? Gasoline is a commodity. It's on every corner. And some people chase it down to find the, you know, cheapest, most, you know, 1 or 2 cent savings. You don't want to be there. That's That's called the race to the bottom. You want to deal with on value, show the value to your client and explain to them why you have to raise prices. At this point, everybody gets it because they see what's happened in the grocery store. We all have to eat. And everybody's seen the prices go up in the grocery store. So just be honest and explain it.
Yeah, I like that strategy, being honest always and explaining it. I just don't know that. I don't know. I kind of feel like we're all tired of that. You know, the surcharge for gas or whatever, the restaurants with the surcharges and stuff now. I don't know. Is the pushback worth the risk?
You know, in my experience, I don't think we have a choice as small business owners. So if I can give a quick example, as a small business owner, you see your costs going up every day, right? The cost of wages, your payroll taxes, your insurance has gone through the roof, right? Up 20%. For your commercial liability insurance, your health insurance, right? Up 20%. Everything's up. So you can't just grow 5 or 10% anymore. You have to grow a little more and you got to stay laser focused on the margin or else you're going to make less money. So you really don't have a choice. Now, in my experience, it's all about how you present it. You know, some people, there's two sides of the fence on this restaurant surcharge. Some people are like, just raise the darn price, you know, make the steak $40, right? Instead of 35, instead of putting 35 on my menu and then charging me a 3% surcharge. It's really fascinating. So
don't most consumers just find that tricky and devious and dislike that? I'd rather have 40 with no surcharge.
I'm the same way as you. I'd rather have it baked into the price because the less you can mess around with the prices, the better off you are, right? You know, staying straight with it is $40. And that way the person knows right away whether or not it fits in their budget. But you have to be able to maintain your pricing power as a business owner, and I hate to say this because it comes out abrupt, but you're going to go out of business. You will reach a point, if you're not able to maintain that balance, maintain your margin, that you're going to make less money. And either you're going to be forced out of business or you're going to give up. You're going to say, you know what, I'm better off just going to get a job.
But we don't want that. That's the last thing us entrepreneurs are allowed to do. We have to stay and fight the fight.
That's right.
Are you finding that the tariffs and the economic uncertainty are affecting any of your clients, any of the businesses you're working with?
Yes, totally. You know, first of all, economic uncertainty is not good for business, right? People do not feel good about spending money when there's uncertainty going on. So they're not going to want to buy new equipment, new trucks, hire new people, expand spaces. And tariffs just are part of economic uncertainty, right? They've driven up costs. You know, some of my manufacturing clients have to pay more for raw materials, right? Due to the tariffs. So that's going to lead to, you have to raise the price. You can't, you know, you have an equation when you run a factory, a profit equation. And it's really not that profitable if you dig in. And if you have to pay for a tariff, because you're ultimately going to find that your costs are increasing and you must pass it on to your customer. There's no other way around it. So yes. And the people that don't have the cash reserve, they don't have any choice. They're forced to make decisions right away.
So how is your business doing, Manny? Are you having challenges right now or still getting the same number of calls, more calls because people are more challenged? How is this affecting your business? Briefly tell people about what you do with your outsourcing of CFOs. Sure.
So for the last 22 years, I've helped business owners across the country improve their profits, you know, fix cash flow problems, and then build businesses that can thrive. you know, even when the economy doesn't cooperate. I find that during periods of this economic uncertainty, as you mentioned, Jim, more people are calling, right? Because when times were good and cash comes in, we're human beings. You know, some of us feel like the ride is never going to end. So yes, I do tend to see a little bit of more of an uptick during times of economic uncertainty. But overall, my business remains steady because people, I recommend that they always be in a position where they have choices. And once I get that across to the customer, they understand the value, right? They don't want to be forced into doing something.
Right. Describe your core offerings. Let's just talk about the business for a second. What do you do for people?
Sure. Great question. So I work on a fixed fee monthly retainer. I am your financial navigator. You're the CEO. You're trying to manage the business. You've got 10 hats on. You rely on me to make sure that you have timely and accurate information to manage your business. So what I do is I take the lessons that I learned working with three billionaire business families. You know, they taught me a lot about how big businesses work because my parents are immigrants. They came from Greece and I come from modest means. So it was a great learning experience. So I do a credit review every month with each client where I will sit down with you, Jim, and we will go over your financial statement together, just the same way that a bank does, same way that an investor looks at you. So there's no surprises. And you know exactly what you're looking at, exactly how your business is performing. And we want to catch a negative trend before it takes root. And that process generally takes about an hour a month or less. It's not boring. And then during the rest of the month, I'm available for questions. There's a lot of questions that get answered. Hey, when can I hire? I want a new office. I want to buy a new machine. You know, I want to buy a new car. There's still a lot that goes on.
Yes, there is. And how have you grown the business? Is it, do you market or you just do word of mouth? How is it perpetuated?
I do. My business has grown through referral over the past 22 years. So I feel very blessed about that, but I do market. I have, you know, my website set up and I'm constantly doing, you know, webinars on different topics of interest. And I'm certainly always out and about networking.
What kind of networking do you do? Chamber events? Here in the South, the chambers have died. But that's a different topic. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so I'm in the Mid-Atlantic. And, you know, what we're doing here, because of the same thing, the chambers are dying. The chambers get together with other groups. So they'll have like three groups, one of which will be the chamber, and they do a networking event. So that's been very helpful because they get 100 people in the room. So, you know, find your local groups, local business forums, local associations. And even though I live in a small state, I live in Maryland, there's still quite a few of these organizations. So I definitely go to events. I pick and choose.
Yeah, the events can be great or useless. How do you know in advance which ones are worth going to?
You don't. But well, here's what I did for myself. I said, you know what? I'm going to this event to meet one person, you know, and hopefully I'm going to meet a banker because commercial bankers have all my clients, right? So hopefully I'm going to meet a banker. And if I can't meet a banker, I'm looking to meet a business owner. So I keep it really simple. That's it. And you never know. But chances are, I might run into one or the other.
Right. And then what does the pitch look like? Is it a soft sell? Or how do you say, I'm here to, you know, prevent you from screwing up? It could almost be a little insulting.
Yeah, it's an excellent point you make. The initial meeting and conversation at these networking groups, there is no pitch. It's just informational. Hey, how you doing, Jim? My name's Manny. What do you do, Jim? Manny, what do you do? It's just kind of informational and getting a feel for people, you know? And again, there's no pitch. People don't like that anyway, right? You meet somebody, you don't even know who they are, and they're immediately trying to sell you something, right?
Yes.
So
there's one guy here in the Atlanta area that sells logo crap, mm-hmm. and he shows up everywhere. Everywhere right. I go, I see him. And he's always trying to sell me logo crap. And every time I see him, I just run the other way.
Right.
The last thing I need is more crap with my logo.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just trying to build mutually beneficial relationships with people. And you never know where the introduction or the referral is going to come from. But you just know a bunch of people. And in my experience, that's the value.
And do you hope the book will help with this? What is your goal personally with the book?
You know, I feel blessed that I was able to get my experiences down on paper. I want people to feel that, you know, it's not hopeless when a downturn hits. There are ways. Here is exactly how you should behave. So I have the goal of giving people hope, right? Here is a proven playbook. Very simple.
Yeah.
You know, I am not looking for, you know, fame and notoriety and everything else. I've got a series of lessons that I was taught by my teachers and mentors. It works. And, you know, here it is. And it's a short book and it's a fun book. And there it is. It's laid out for you. You don't need to go down into your hole if a downturn hits. Here's the actions you can take.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen in the next year in terms of the macro economy? You know, they've been saying that a recession is coming for about 5 years now, it feels like. What do you think is going to happen at the macro level?
Here's how I answer that question. When my clients ask me that question, I tell them, you know what, let me get my crystal ball out. And when I get it out, I look at it and I ask them, Jim, what do you think I see in my crystal ball?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. That's why
I see my face looking back at me. You know, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. It's mere speculation. All I can tell you is make sure you keep that business profitable every month. Make sure you spot a negative trend before it takes hold. Make sure that you have some kind of cash reserve. And that's all you can do. Because everything else is speculation.
How do you set your price for your clients and how do you justify it to them?
Great question. So we have a conversation about the value. You know, we ask what the client's outcomes are. What outcomes do you want? And we identify those outcomes and then we agree on a value. You know, this achieving these outcomes might result in $450,000 in value this year. Not to mention the future years. So if it's $450,000 in value that we agree on, I like to work on a 10-to-1 return on investment. So my fee would be $45,000. The client makes 10-to-1. So it's important to have a good, solid discussion about the client's outcomes and the value that's associated with that outcome. And it makes it easy.
How do you get the 450 number?
Well, I just gave you a number, but
I know, but in the conversation,
it could be savings. You know, it could be savings. You know, we might make some tweaks to some processes internally that might lead to savings, right? We might make some tweaks that lead to an increase in the margin. We might make some tweaks that lead to additional sales. There is a whole host of ways that we can unlock value in a business. Right? So by making additional profit in that business, what other doors are open to you as the business owner? Right? You can hire more people, right? You could buy more machinery. You could give yourself a bonus, which is always welcome, right? You can establish that cash reserve. So all that gets driven off of value.
How many clients can you handle typically at one time?
I generally work with 24 clients. So 24. And they're mostly on monthly retainer. And the other piece of my business is project work, where somebody will call me up and say, you know what? I am not getting my financial information on time. Can you come in here and evaluate my accounting department? Right? Or I'm having a cash crunch. Or I'm not, you know, my profits are down. I grew my company, you know, from 5 million to 10 million, and now I'm making less money. So that would be project work.
Okay. And is that on an hourly basis or a flat fee for that?
Flat fee. Yes, sir. Flat fee. Same thing. Value-based flat fee.
And what about AI? Is it going to have any impact on your business?
Oh, yeah. That's a fun one. So it's already having an impact. Like, so for me personally, when I first started out, and I was certainly younger, my number was 40 clients a month, 2 clients a day, right? Because it included driving back then, 5 days a week times 4 weeks. It was a 40 client max. And then Zoom, you know, all these software tools came along, Jim. Then Zoom became easy to use, right? That's their claim to fame. That was helpful. People decided that, you know what? I don't want to be sitting in traffic. I don't want to put makeup on. Let me just get on a Zoom for 5 minutes with Manny. So all those tools helped. And now we've got AI. AI has helped me save even more time and made me efficient. So for the webinars, I'm using AI to do all the design and stuff, because I used to have to outsource that to a designer, but now I can do the design in minutes. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff.
And is the AI helping you with your makeup?
Not particularly for me, but for my lady CEOs, right? Uh-huh. That don't want to get made up and spend an hour and a half in traffic to come and meet. They can just jump right on. But, you know, this is just an amazing time. It's resulting in inefficiencies, which is helping to boost productivity and is going to result in, you know, more profitability. So it's great. Now, I don't know where. Yes. Right,
finish up your thought.
I don't know where it goes, but it's an exciting time, and I highly recommend that everybody, you know, dips their toe in it.
Yeah. You know, the hard part is it just sits there waiting on you to do something, to ask it something, you know, so.
For now, eventually it'll be like Mr. Scott. Remember Mr. Scott from Star Trek used to say, computer?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I can see that coming.
Not that long away. Manny, how do we find out more about you, follow you online, get a copy of the book?
Yes, the book is available at Amazon. Just put my name in there or Small Business Perseverance. And I have a host of information at my website, Jim. It's portalcfo.com, portalcfo.com. And there will be my social media links. It will be on the website and everything.
Fantastic. Manny, thank you so much for being with us. I hope the book sells well, and we'll talk to you next year.
Jim, thanks again for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us today. I'm excited to welcome back to the show Barbara Hales, Dr. Barbara Hales. She is doing something very unique. She helps other doctors, physicians, and healthcare professionals, dentists, grow their practice. She is involved in marketing and helping them boost their online rankings and making them show up in lists, in Google lists, and things like that. Dr. Hales, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Jim, thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure.
Tell us your story of leaving doctoring.
Well, when I first went into training, I had exposure to all different medical settings, big hospitals, small hospitals, clinics, urgent centers, emergency rooms. But in getting all that exposure, it crystallized for me that what I really wanted to do was to go into private practice. That way, I could have a personal relationship with each patient and get to know them personally and not have someone over my head saying, you only have 7 minutes, and then move on to the next one. So however long it took, I wanted to, you know, really get to know my patients well. So I found an office space that I thought was ideal. Originally, it was a candy store, and my biggest regret is that they did not leave their inventory. But after that, I, you know, decorated it in a homey way, got the necessary equipment and staff, and, you know, signed up for everything legally that I had to do. And then it was launch day. It was so exciting. What I did is to open the doors, ready for business, and crickets. Because I had no patients, none, not one, because it was just starting out. I didn't buy a practice. I didn't partner with another person. It was me, myself, and I. So after being open for 2 minutes, it really came to me that if I did not market myself, then 3 weeks from launch day, I would be closing the practice. So in those days, doctors did not market themselves, and there were no mentors to show you the ropes. So, you know, I had to, through trial and error, see what worked and what didn't. Fortunately, more work than not. So I developed my own systems. Using them, I was able to go from no patients to 10,000 active patients over the course of the practice time, which was very exciting.
Those are some numbers. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, very proud of that. And it just shows you the power of successful marketing.
Right. Very impressive. And we'll get there. So what kind of doctor are you? What is your specialty? Are you a GP
obstetrics and gynecology. Okay. Yeah, an MD.
Uh-huh. I think that is one of the, I'm not going to say that either. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, go ahead.
Oh, your turn.
Your show.
So I don't think doctors are very good at business. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely correct. Unfortunately, when you go into medical school, you learn everything there is to know about medicine and about the body and about healing. And they teach you zero about marketing, zero about business. And so if you're not becoming a hospitalist or just joining a hospital staff, you're on your own. Which can be good, may not be good. You know, there is a big secret, you know, across all of America that most people don't know. And that is that there are doctors now that are going bankrupt. And they are going to have to sell the practice to a hospital, or they're going to be turning the keys in the lock and just walking away. So
is that because they didn't join a larger system?
No, it's because they really were not knowledgeable about business, about promoting themselves and marketing. And, you know, unless you're in the middle of nowhere and you're the only doctor in town, with competition, you really have to, you know, show people that you are unique. And that you are, you know, better than your competition. Otherwise, they'll be going to the doctor down the road and you will be sitting with crickets the way I did the first day I launched.
Right. So what were the first things you did to be successful? What was the first thing you did that actually made a difference and clicked?
Well, the very first thing that I did when I moved to a new community was to join the Chamber of Commerce. I wanted everyone, you know, that could then refer to know that I was in town, where I was located, and what I did. So this was prior to launch day. And then on launch day, when I said I needed to really, you know, market myself, I called the head of the chamber and said, you know, listen, since I am a member of the chamber, I'm going to suggest something. And, you know, like, hopefully you'll say yes, but this is really, you know, with your permission. And that is, I would like to take a big ad out on the front page of the local newspaper, which says the following. The Chamber of Commerce welcomes its newest member with my name, address, telephone number, and what I did. And that's it. I just wanted people to know that I was there. And because there was no, you know, salesy, you know, ad, that they said, you know, go for it, because it was really promoting them as well as myself. And the day after the newspaper hit, the phone started ringing off the hook.
Wow. What kind of community was that? How big a city?
Well, it was a, you know, it was kind of like a bigger than a village, but it was maybe 20,000 people in town.
Okay. I wonder now, you know, if that chamber still would do that. Most chambers are trying to get out of small business and move into big business only. And that's really sad. The chambers across the country are dying and no one's really talking about it. I was wondering if that chamber had done the same. Do you know that? Are you following that chamber still?
I don't think so. And I could tell you that where I'm currently living, the chambers are really doing live and well.
Well, it depends on the size. You know, 20,000, there is no big business there to move toward, you know, so it would depend. Where do you live now? Are we allowed to know that?
Sure, why not? I live in a place called Boynton Beach, which is in the southeast section of Florida.
Oh, of course.
Isn't
Santa Rosa Beach close to there?
No, that I think that may be on the west side.
Oh, okay.
I am about 8 to 10 miles north of Boca and Delray.
Okay, Boca. I know Boca.
Yeah, everybody does.
Yes.
And about an hour and a half north of Miami.
Right. All right. So when did you decide to move into helping other doctors and become a marketing guru as well?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, through, you know, no great desire to become a marketer, it was something that I needed to do for survival. So over the course of time in my medical practice, you know, I was a marketer and creating my own systems. So to transition into actually calling myself that really was not a stretch. When I decided to leave private practice, I looked around to all of my colleagues and none of them were marketing. None of them really had a clue as to marketing. And so I felt that, you know, this is something I needed to do because, you know, I felt that if something were not to be done, in 10 to 12 years from now, there might not be private practice as an option so that people would no longer be able to go to their personal physician and they would have to go to a large setting. And I did not want that to happen. So it's my mission that as long as I can help others, that private practice would not go by the same way as, you know, Photomat and Sears and all these other places that you knew when you were younger, but no longer exist.
Right. I love that attitude. Thank you for doing that. And so what are the mistakes they're making? Is the biggest mistake just no action whatsoever?
Well, when I approach doctors and I say to them, you know, do you have a marketing program? And the typical reaction that I get is, well, I don't really have time to market myself. I don't know how to market myself, and I don't have the budget to market myself. Whereupon I point out to them that, you know, marketing is simply telling people where you're located, and what you do, what your products and services are that you offer. Can you imagine telling people what you do, but saying, but you'll have to guess where I am? Or, this is my location, but guess what I do? Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it?
Yep, that would be funny.
So breaking it down that way, they could understand that, you know, in simplest terms, if you like want to survive, then you need to communicate with people. You need to communicate, tell them what you do, what you offer, maybe what makes you unique, what your mission is, and you know, like where you're located and how they could get to you.
That doesn't sound unreasonable. And do we do anything to differentiate ourselves, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the thing is that even until today, shockingly enough, and just saying it always shocks me, that there are physicians and medical, you know, clinics out there that do not have their own website. Can you believe that?
That is shocking.
That they feel their online presence is provided by places like Yelp, and the insurance companies that they participate with, you know, all put them online as a provider within their panel. And so, you know, that's enough. And one day they'll get to it. But they don't realize that without their website, they have no control over the information that is disseminated, and that one day will probably be never. That I find is the biggest mistake. The second mistake is when a doctor does not take into consideration the rankings and reviews that people put online about them. You know, nowadays it doesn't matter whether a doctor is referred by a respected family person or another physician that they're seeing. Statistics show that 8 out of every 10 people will not make an appointment until they've gone online to see who this person is, what their reviews are, what their ranking is. And no matter how good they are, if they have like 1 or 2 stars and they have reviews that do not bode well, they're not going to get people to make an appointment with them. And that's one of the biggest mistakes. Unfortunately, a lot of times the rating really has not reflected the doctor themselves. It's the entire office experience when somebody comes in. Do they have to wait a long time before seeing the doctor? Is the front desk person like rude and snappy because she's overtired? Is the billing unacceptable? Is the office where you're waiting not clean, or you know, like torn fabric? Like all of this goes into the experience that somebody, you know, has when they walk through that door. So it's the whole view. And it's important for, you know, not only a doctor, but you know, like any business person, you know, opening their business, no matter what it is, to have an objective eye, to walk in like it's not your place, and to take into account what people who are coming to you are seeing. Because that's certainly going to affect your, you know, their perception of you.
You know, it's amazing. I've looked at some reviews. It's amazing how many of them said, I never went to this doctor, but I met the receptionist and decided not to go to the doctor. So 1 star. And you're like,
yeah.
You know, it is, I think, there's so many factors that go into the reviews there. Couldn't find parking. And so the doctor gets a bad review.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I first started my practice and I had people fill out a form, you know, I always had, you know, like, how did you hear about me? And I always had like, what, you know, I had no mistaken notion that nobody had been to a doctor before me. So obviously they were transferring from whoever they were going to. And so on the form, you know, they put down what, you know, why it is that they were coming to my office as opposed to staying where they were. And people would say, you know, because the parking was abominable and I didn't want to have to drive around for half an hour before I got to the office. Which, you know, does make sense on one hand, but, you know, when you're picking an office, these are things that you really have to take into consideration. Is the office getting exposure from a main street? Is there parking provided? And if not, then, you know, like maybe, you know, one should think about a valet service. After all, your restaurants do it, your museums do it. You know, like if the parking is truly impossible, you know, maybe you should be doing it too.
Yes. Yes. So how close are we getting to I'm a better doctor than you in ads and in just out there in the world?
You know, it's not a question of whether they are a better doctor. It's a question of how they're marketing themselves. Because if they are a better marketer and their website is better and their social media is better, then people see them as better, whether they're better or not.
Okay. But you don't think we'll ever get to a point where doctors are advertising, we're better than that guy? Or not that,
no. No,
not comparison, but just saying, look how good I am. I'm, you know, specialist. Look how.
No, that won't happen for a very specific reason. Well, that's what I was just going to get to.
Okay.
And that is, you know, as opposed to businesses being able to do that, doctors are bound by like HIPAA laws.
Right.
And restrictions. And so even if they were talking about a medication as an ad, you can't say, you know, this medication is better than that. You know, you can't put that in print because that really is against HIPAA code. But what you can do is you can show through stories, you can show through testimonials that, you know, you're like, the beloved person.
Right.
You know, rather than you know, tooting your own horn, if other people are doing so as testimonials, as people that have, you know, had your services, gone to your office and think you're like, you know, like the next best thing to Gandhi, then, you know, that is going to be a lot more powerful than any information that came directly out of your office.
What percent of doctors today leave residency and go into a private practice, whether they're the lead or not? And how many of them go straight into a hospital mega system?
You know, those numbers vary so frequently. That's really not something that, you know, I could say with any assurity.
I'm sorry. Is it a number that's going, are we having more and more independents or less and less over time? What's the trend line?
Well, you know, the trend actually is a moving line because at one point, you know, in the not so recent past, when people were finishing their training, they were saying, you know, I think that I'm just going to become a hospitalist. I'm just going to sign in as being an employee of the hospital and essentially, you know, just, you know, punching in the card, going to work, doing the 8 to 10 hours and then leaving. And so that they would be able to have a better work-life balance. They would be able to take vacations that were maybe subsidized by their employer and, you know, have a less stressful life. But there is a trade-off for that, which they started discovering and which is why the line moves back and forth. And that is, you know, not everybody is meant to be like a company man. Not everybody can take can take orders from somebody above them, especially somebody who is not actually trained in medicine. So, you know, you might get people to say, well, you know, in terms of, you know, ROI, that you need to see a certain amount of patients per hour, that you need to prescribe certain medications because they're cheaper. There are certain treatment options that maybe you shouldn't necessarily suggest because they cost more. And, you know, most doctors really are not built that way.
Right.
They're not, you know, if they're ethical. So that's why the line moves back and forth, because, you know, they may say, oh, this is great. Somebody else is getting the patients. Somebody else is paying for the liability insurance. But then, you know, it's a trade-off, and not everybody can work within somebody else's setting.
Right. Just absolutely fascinating to me. My father was a physician. He was a pathologist, and he very quickly migrated toward running his own group of pathologists, and because he just didn't play well with others. If he wasn't the boss, he just didn't do well.
Yeah, so, that's exactly what I mean.
Yes. But he ended up being a very good business person. So.
Well, that's good. Well, he didn't have any patients that complained.
Yeah, they were all dead. No, he mostly made, you know, pathologists make most of their money looking at slides and seeing whether that's cancer or not. And so,
yeah,
he was looking at slides.
Well, I will let you in on a little secret, probably is not something that you have ever heard on your radio station. And that is, you know, as a physician, when, you know, I did surgery, and when you're in the OR and you have something that needs to go to the pathology department for a frozen section, is what it's called, when they're making an emergency slide and they're reading it and getting the diagnosis back to you, like within 20, 25 minutes, so that it will determine what your further course of action was in the OR.
Yes.
So, you know, surgery was done. It was performed, and then, you know, the surgical site was covered while one of the nurses or orderlies took the specimens and ran down to the pathology department, which for some reason is always like in the basement in most hospitals, and if there is a basement, and then wait for the result, and then either run up with the result or have it come through like an intercom.
Yes.
So I must say, during that 20 or 25 minute wait, like, what would a person do? What would you do? I will tell you what we did, and it probably was not unique to us alone. And that is, in that 20 to 25 minutes was the time when we exchanged jokes. And my best jokes, like the ones I heard that were the best, was usually during that time.
Do you remember any?
No.
Oh. Barbara, how do we find out more about you, follow you online, get in touch with you?
You can go to my website, which is themedicalstrategist, that's STRATEGIST.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us. Great information, and I hope medicine in America stays as good as it is.
Well, thank you for having me, Jim. It was a pleasure.
It was my pleasure as well. We are out of time. Please be safe. Take care. Bye now.